Welcome to the Birth Lounge Podcast, an empowering space for expecting and new parents to hear candid conversations with experts, support your mental health, and learn the tips and tricks that thousands of parents have used to craft their ideal birth. We will answer all of your questions, the scary ones and the weird ones, to help calm your fears and feel confident going into your birth. I'm going to help you redefine what birth and motherhood looks like and how to embrace your journey. I've intentionally crafted an amazing list of experts to help you navigate pregnancy, explore your birth options, and plan for postpartum so it can be a time of soaking in your tiny human. We're going to go there on all the hard topics so that you can dive into finding your confidence and freeing yourself from fears around childbirth. With almost 10 years of experience in family education and a master's degree in human development and family studies, I created this podcast as a way to share information so parents can make educated and informed decisions about their care during pregnancy and childbirth. This is a birth community driven by evidence-based information and research in hopes to help you explore your options, understand your rights, and know what choices you have along the way. I'm your host, Hee. Now let's get to the good stuff. Hi, before I dive into this episode, I wanted to make sure that you knew about my free guide to Pitocin use. It's a PDF download that breaks down everything that you need to know about Pitocin use. What does the FDA say about proper and safe use? How do we typically see it be used in American hospitals? If those two things differ, what kind of data do you need to be aware of in terms of the different uses of Pitocin? Where are some places in labor where Pitocin actually might be useful? How do you know if you're getting too much, too fast? How do you know what the hospital policy is, plus what are your other options, plus what you can say no to, plus what you can request? Well, it's all in the PDF guide, and that's totally free for you. So you can go to thebirthlounge.com/Pitocin. That's P-I-T-O-C-I-N, Pitocin, and download that. It's a comprehensive guide, got everything you need to know, plus how to have these conversations with your provider to make sure that your birth goals are met and respected during your labor. Again, you can find that at thebirthlounge.com/Pitocin. All right, now on to the episode. Hello! All right, y'all, welcome back to another episode of the Birth Lounge Podcast. Holy smoke show, I am freaking excited for today's episode. So I found today's guest online. She's someone I have followed for a really long time and someone I look up to, someone I really admire, someone who I think is doing exceptional work out there, Dr. Rachel Reed. She is an author, educator, researcher, and midwife in the UK. She has practiced midwifery in a range of contexts in the UK and Australia, including hospitals, community-based group practice, and as an independent home birth midwife. She spent her years getting her PhD exploring midwifery practice and particularly studying the physiological birth process. Unfortunately, she no longer practices midwifery, and now she spends her time doing things like this, educating us all. And I, for one, am so excited to have her here. I'm super, super stoked and honored to be able to learn from her. Dr. Rachel has published books, journals, magazines, and she writes on her blog regularly so that people like you and I can have access to evidence-based information to help make our decisions in labor. As a researcher, Dr. Rachel studies women's experiences of birth and the influence of care provider interactions. Ooh la la, you know that speaks to my heart. Today, in particular, I'm going to be talking with Dr. Reed about 5 non-evidence-based reasons that we see induction. So if you have been going to your prenatal appointments and your provider is dropping the I word, induction, or trying to get you to get an induction on the calendar without a medical reason, this one is for you. This episode is going to speak directly to your heart, and it's going to equip you with the knowledge and the information and the data to help you either decline that if if it doesn't feel aligned to you, or to have more discussion with your provider if you are interested in induction. I cannot wait for you to hear this conversation. So without further ado, Dr. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being here. I'm very, very excited for this conversation because I know that A, it's kind of a hot topic. B, it's something that probably every single pregnant person is going to face if you're birthing within the hospital system, and sometimes even home birth. And it's a topic that I think it's on everybody's mind. People just want to make the right decision. So today we're talking about induction. And I think that we're going to come from a lens of things that you can do to avoid kind of traumatic inductions, things that you need to know that may not necessarily be disclaimed to you in the hospital system. Usually in the hospital, it is presented maybe one-sided. You don't always get both the risk and the benefits. And so today, I think we'd really like to peel back the layers of like just exactly what you're getting into with an induction, just so you know what you're agreeing to, right? So I'm just going to throw the ball your way. I know everybody has strong opinions and feelings about induction. So when I say induction, what are your thoughts that come to your mind?
Oh, well, from a personal work perspective, it's like, oh no, not that topic again. Yeah. I wrote a book about this in 2017 because I was asked, and I kind of thought, that'll be it. I've got it all written down. I don't have to get into it again. But as you have just said, it is increasing and increasing every year. There are more and more and more inductions, and when I look at it, I kind of go, I'm not surprised, because you know, you need to understand what underpins the development of maternity systems and who holds the power there. So it's not a surprise, but it is frustrating because, as you say, you know, women are not being given full information to make decisions. They're only getting kind of one part of it, and certainly not individualized information. And you know, and the reasons for induction are increasing, and it's not about evidence, and it's not even about clinical guidelines. You know, so I did a talk in New Zealand a couple of weeks back, and I was asked to talk about induction, and I pulled up their clinical guidelines. So this is for the country's guidelines, and it was written by obstetricians, researchers, midwives, you know, people who had a lot of knowledge, and they looked at all the evidence and they created the guidelines, and they actually did a good job. And I created a slide from what the guidelines said. And the guidelines basically stated that there was insufficient evidence to support induction of labor for everything, pretty much. There was moderate for two reasons. That was post-date, so post-term pregnancies, and hypertension, chronic hypertension. Everything else was insufficient or low. And their recommendations were not to induce, to not offer induction for big babies, gestational diabetes, blah, blah, blah. And yet in the clinical practice, in the hospitals, the midwives are saying, but they are inducing for those things. So they're not even following their own evidence-based guidelines. So that was a long rant about what I get frustrated about when the word induction is mentioned.
Yet that just scratched the surface of like the whole topic of induction. It really is so deep, and there are like so many rabbit holes you can go down. So the first thing that you mentioned was kind of the rise in induction. And I've been attending birth since 2016, and I can say wholeheartedly we're seeing that like in our clients as well. It is truly a conversation that is had with nearly 100% of people who are birthing in the hospital system. And it is varying degrees of when it's introduced to the pregnancy. Sometimes literally first trimester, they're already talking about scheduling inductions. And we're talking about with first-time moms, you guys, not people who have had babies, but first-time moms, sometimes it's kind of a bait and switch that's right there at the end. Why do you think we're seeing such a rise in induction, especially if so many of the reasons that we're doing them are not evidence-based?
Because it fits with our culture. So if we consider the kind of birth culture and what our mainstream birth culture came out of, it actually arose from the development of physicians and the introduction of physicians into birth and then birth into hospitals. And birth became this, you know, not a life event that was happening in people's homes with midwives attending and sometimes physicians invited if there was a complication. It became this medical event alongside, you know, other operations that were happening in hospital. So when you start then looking at it like that, and you also look at how women's bodies were started to be seen as, I mean, they were always seen as dirty and dangerous throughout history. But once the Industrial Revolution kind of came about and we started looking at bodies as machines, we started to see women's bodies as inefficient and that technology and medicine could make the body more effective and efficient at birthing. And, you know, women welcomed that because to some extent, the move to medicine enabled some women and babies to be saved that previously would have died. So it was kind of this trade-off of, you know, midwives inviting medicine into births where they had done all they could. And in some cases, the mother and baby could be saved. So, you know, we kind of bought into that and then along came what was attached to it. And that's what we're trying to unpick now. But if we're in a culture where, and this was before research evidence, so all of these ideas about what it, when labor should happen, what it should look like, were created when birth was happening in hospitals, when it was routinely augmented, medicalized. So we don't really know about physiological birth, and we need women's bodies to fit through those systems efficiently and effectively. So we started to make labors a certain length and induce babies so we could control when they were born. And that's what it underpins. It underpins this message that babies need to come out of women at a particular point and in a particular way in order for it to be safe. And that safety happens through intervention, which is interesting because we now have science showing the opposite. And we even have the Lancet. So, you know, this is medicine. You know, I'm not talking here from a non-medical natural birth perspective because that has its own issues. You know, we have medicine, the Lancet, saying that a big problem in our culture today is that a huge amount of women in the world are dying and their babies are dying because there is not access to medicine. So they are having too little too late when they need it. And yet in the Western world, what we have is a situation of too much too soon. And that is now causing the increase in complications. It is causing the increase in maternal and infant mortality. So we've kind of done this flip into, and it just keeps going because it fits the culture. If you are building care around an organization, you want women to come in, to have their baby within a set amount of time, to use lots of intervention that allows you to, particularly in the US and in the private system in Australia, to make money. There is no money in a physiological birth. There's none. There is a lot of money in a medicalized birth. And if that's all you're seeing, then that's what you'll get really good at. So in the US, you are really good at medical births, which is why you actually have quite good outcomes for induction. Not as good as physiological birth, but pretty good because you're good at it. You're good at elective cesareans. And in that culture, it's not going to change until we start to center physiology as the foundation for understanding birth. And we start to center women's experiences of birth and look at long-term outcomes. Because the other thing the organizations do is they count short-term. So they look at, did the mother and baby survive? Was there a big hemorrhage? Was there a clinical complication at that moment? They don't count mental health problems from traumatic birth that then come into the system through a different, they're going somewhere else. They're going to the mental health system. They're not seeing that. They're not seeing the babies who are struggling to breastfeed because they're early term. So they're 39 weeks and they haven't matured enough to initiate breastfeeding effectively. So these women struggle, you know, and we had a podcast about that where Katie talked about, you know, all these issues that these early term babies have. They're not counting that as a risk or an outcome.
You know what I also find interesting playing off of you saying kind of like, because we're intervening, we're causing all these things. I find the litigation piece of it very interesting. A lot of what obstetricians do is based in / driven by the fear of litigation. But we know that much of what they do causes the litigation, because had they just been human, had they not tried to cover their ass, had they not tried to say like, oh, we don't know why this happened, when we absolutely do know why this happened. We made a mistake. We thought this. We acted on that. We made a mistake. We're very, very sorry about that. Instead, you land yourself in litigation because patients feel dismissed and they feel unheard and they feel silenced and they feel like you did not have their best interests at heart. So it's that's like double whammy of things that we've tried to do to be preventative that have come back and bitten us in the butt, if you will. And it makes me just think like, what if we just take a step back from maternity care? Because it is so different than what the rest of the hospital is, right? People come to the hospital because they're sick, but not in maternity care. People come to the hospital because they don't have the skills to do what they need with their heart, with their lungs, with their leg, right? Not in maternity care. For the most part, people are coming to the hospital because they just want to be supervised by doctors. They have innately, if we taught them so, what they need to have their babies, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's also intertangled. And I think it for me, just, it kind of reiterates what we were saying at the beginning, that this is a much deeper issue. This is like, it's deeper than just induction, but control is part of it. Money is part of it. Efficiency is part of it. Litigation is part of it. It's like just a very deep and entangled subject.
It is. And it's really about kind of women's position in society and culture, because it's really interesting, isn't it, that so maternity care is the least evidence-based. In fact, it won the wooden spoon back in the 90s for being the least evidence-based speciality, because it's not. Unlike the rest of healthcare, tends to be really evidence-based. You know, there's good trials to demonstrate medications and interventions are effective. That doesn't happen in maternity care. They'll just implement something with no evidence, and then you have to get evidence to support not doing the thing that they implemented without evidence. So that's a big change in maternity. Also, that they primarily look after women, and they're not concerned, interestingly, in terms of litigation, they're not concerned about being sued for coercing women into interventions that they didn't need and the outcomes of that. The laws of consent are the same in the US as they are in other Western countries. And time again, consent is not valid because women are being misinformed and they're being coerced into having interventions that they don't fully understand and then may or may not have a bad outcome. It doesn't matter whether it does. If you do something without consent, it's legally assault and battery. Nobody's scared of that in healthcare, even though it happens, you know, so much. So it's just interesting when we talk about litigation, what it is that everybody's scared of, because they're not scared of coercing and assaulting and battering women.
No, yet you hear it thrown around all the time, you know, that, well, you don't want this person to sue us, or you don't want this person to come after us, or you never know how patients are going to react. Or sometimes we even hear doctors tell patients, like, if I let you do this, I would lose my medical license. Like, just simply not true, first of all. And, you know, and it's, I'm always blown away when that happens, I think, because it just does show like, wow, this is way bigger than just consent. This is way bigger than just teaching these doctors to ask the appropriate questions, or to teach them how to properly get informed consent with every procedure, with every touch, with every decision that's made. It's deeper than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe if women start suing also for the complications associated with interventions.
Yeah.
But they don't, you hear that time and time again. Oh, you get sued. You don't get sued for doing something, you get sued for not doing something, like not doing the cesarean. Well, maybe if, you know, we started to sue for doing the induction that results in fetal distress, that results in, you know, the cesarean section, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, maybe we'd change things. But I kind of almost think that the litigation is used as an excuse a lot of the time, but that is not really the fundamental problem here.
Yeah. No, yeah, I definitely don't think it's the fundamental problem. I think it's a large problem, but I don't think it's the main problem. Gosh, litigation, it makes me think, though, the people who do try and bring litigation against hospitals, it's very, very difficult. And they often have a hard time, like, finding, you know, even representation to represent them against the hospital. And I think charting is another something that can be good or bad. Hopefully the charting was really good, but a lot of times patients report that maybe their medical records don't actually match up what happened, or that really major things were somehow left out of their medical records, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. This makes it very hard for people to actually take action against hospitals, which I think is also really problematic. If there's no sort of accountability for the hospitals and these providers and the bad things that are happening for that unnecessary intervention, how are we ever going to get better, you know? And maybe the answer is what you mentioned before, people leaving the system. People are getting out. Women are leaving in droves these days. We're seeing home birth rise. We're seeing people go to birth centers. We're seeing people seek alternative care to the traditional hospital system. Do you think that's the answer? What do you think is the answer here to holding these hospitals accountable for these things? And maybe there's not a simple answer.
No, there isn't. And I think I agree with you. What I'm seeing, so after, you know, decades in this as a midwife for a lot of it, that's what I'm seeing more recently. And it's really quite, you know, it's really interesting to watch this grassroots kind of growth. And I think it's a lot of it is about social media and, you know, like the kind of things you're doing, which is putting that information out there that, you know, people are starting to go, oh, hang on, there is actually other ways of doing this and I'm not broken. Actually, the system broke me. Or they're starting to see things differently and you're seeing a lot of shift. So, you know, it's the same in Australia. We're seeing much more home births. We're seeing actually a lot more free births. We're seeing, you know, women demanding more. And then if they're not getting it, actually just going and getting it somewhere else. So that is going to cause a shift. We also need a shift in the hospital settings and, you know, because some women do want and need an induction. And those women also deserve respectful care where they are in control of what's happening to them. You know, we need a complete reframe in terms of the culture and in maternity across the board. And, you know, that's a huge, that's a huge shift.
Yeah. And it's not just in hospitals. I find that sometimes the natural birth community can sometimes be very anti-induction, leaving the people who you just mentioned want an induction or actually need a medical induction, feeling kind of isolated, feeling a little maybe jaded or judged. So there is actually a place for everybody. Okay, so let's kind of dive into inductions. We're seeing them for a lot of non-evidence-based reasons. What are the things that we know are like your top couple non-evidence-based reasons? If your provider presents these with you, you should be questioning things and having a deeper discussion.
Goodness, I'm not sure what it is in the US.
Yeah.
There's definitely been a shift. It used to be about post-date pregnancy. That was the primary reason for induction. That's not the main reason now anymore in Australia. Mm. I can't remember what it is. I think it's, I mean, gestational diabetes is one because we've changed the threshold. So we have now, we've got 1 in 6 women in Australia with gestational diabetes, or rather labeled with it. You know, that's a whole other thing. So that's one. I would say big babies seems to be another. Would you agree? What else are you seeing in the US?
So failure to progress is one of our biggest ones. And, you know, that's really frustrating because for many of those births, it's actually like failure to wait. It's failure to properly support the body. It's failure to properly give it time, safety, space, you know, encouragement. So failure to progress is really tough. Funky fetal heart tones is apparently on that list as well. Evidence-based births has a list that is breaks down kind of your top reasons for non-evidence-based reasons of a C-section here in the US. And funky fetal heart tones is on that list, which obviously we want to get a baby out that is struggling and asking for support. I think that anecdotally, our team at least finds that, you know, a C-section is often the first thing. Instead of trying maternal repositioning, instead of looking at the level of Pitocin, instead of looking at, I guess, the effectiveness of the fetal monitoring, they see, you know, one funky fetal heart tone and they jump straight to a C-section, which is really frustrating. And it can be really, really scary. A lot of clients don't understand what is going on in those situations. And so we're finding funky fetal heart tones to be a gray area, not something that you ever want to stop, obviously, if it's not an emergency. And as doulas, we don't have training in funky fetal heart tone and like understanding what those are. So it's tough for doulas, I think, to navigate those situations. We're seeing that our team is.
Okay. So that's once the woman is in labor and And then the reasons for cesarean. Yeah. So the main reason for cesarean during an induction is particularly for first time, because there isn't an increase in cesarean section during induction for women who have previously given birth. But for women having their first babies, there is. And the main reason is that when you're trying to get a woman's body to labor when it's not ready and the baby hasn't signaled and done those, and this is why physiology is so important. And that's why the first course that I created was childbirth physiology, because if you don't understand what happens physiologically, you can't understand how any of these interventions alter that or change that. Or so when you're trying to get a woman's body to do something it's just not ready to do and the baby's not ready to do, then what you have is you're turning up the Pitocin to get the contractions into a pattern that will open the cervix. But to do that, you're stressing the baby out because you're having to so then you lower the Pitocin and then the baby recovers, but you haven't got the contractions. So then you increase the contractions and the baby gets stressed. And that's actually the main reason for a cesarean during an induction, is just you can't get the balance right. So, you know, you end up going, look, we can't give you enough contractions to get the baby out without stressing the baby, so we'll do a cesarean. So it's not really an emergency, you know, nobody's in imminent danger at that point. It's just not, it's a failed induction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's particularly for women having their first baby. So that needs to be shared with women who are choosing induction for their first baby. That's a good chance that's going to happen.
And so here, what ACOG recommends in America is that we've got a couple requirements that if you don't meet these things, you should like go home and try again another day, assuming that it is an elective induction and not a medical induction. And one of those things is not having your waters ruptured. So what would you recommend to people, or what kind of things should people consider if they find themselves with kind of that failed induction, their waters are intact and it was an elective induction, we don't have a medical reason to be inducing?
Well, I guess it's up to them, but they've made the decision that they want to have the baby out and have an induction.
Yeah.
And really, so the idea of an elective induction is interesting, isn't it? Because medicine is about doing no harm. It's like, why are you doing something that doesn't need to happen? You know, back in the day when I was a new grad, inductions, it was when the baby was more at risk in the uterus than out of the uterus. That was the rationale. And we didn't do that many inductions. And for post-dates, I can remember working in the hospital and you kind of go around to the women who had come in for induction and you'd sit and talk to them and you had to check that they were 42 weeks and 13 days, because if they were not, if they were 42 weeks and 11 days, they would be sent home by the midwife in charge.
Wow.
And whereas now, you know, you have all these inductions happening for all kinds of reasons, including elective. And, you know, if you are giving women medication like prostaglandin, there are potential risks for that. To then send them home, I just find that interesting. I think once you've started a process, you're committed to now finishing a process, and that should be shared with women. If we start an induction and it doesn't work, then yes, you can go home, but there may be risks associated with that because we have started to initiate some changes using medication that's not physiological, or you go to an elective cesarean. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I guess the argument would be, you know, there's risk to staying and continuing to force your body through that induction, right? If you go home and get rest, or I guess just give your body a few more days to like get your baby ready and then go back again. Of course, there, like I say, ACOG has guidelines, essentially. You need to have no cervical change for 4 hours. No rupture of your membrane. So once your waters have broken, your baby does have to come out, right? There is no backing up from that. Yeah. So if you're looking at the diagnosis of like a failure to progress, I guess it is just a balancing of the risk of, all right, there's a risk if I go home, there's a risk if I stay, which am I, you know, willing to take on?
Yeah. And really, you know, I think a lot of the safety issues that I'm seeing in maternity care, or this confusion between physiology and non-physiology. With a physiological birth, it's safest. You know, you get the best outcomes when you just back off and do nothing and just support physiology and support the woman because her body knows what it's doing, etc. Once you start a medical birth, which is what I'm going to call a medical birth, is not a physiological birth. You have a whole lot of risks now associated with that. and you need more intervention to mitigate those risks. And the danger comes in treating a physiological birth as if it's a medical birth and intervening routinely, and treating medical birth as if it's a physiological birth, you know, by not monitoring a baby who's being induced, by, you know, not, for example, with pain relief. It's completely different scenario giving an epidural to a woman who's having a physiological birth versus a woman who's having an induction. Totally, the pain is different. You know, a lot of women will absolutely want and need an epidural for the pain of an induced labor. It's a different scenario, and it kind of really, I don't know, it worries me when you hear women saying, I really didn't want to have the epidural because I knew the risks of it, so I just went through an induction with no pain relief. And it's like, well, the risks of the epidural are kind of managed when you're being induced because it's a medical birth. So we're doing all the things, we've already made it risky. So putting an epidural in is not really significantly going to increase the risks of an induced birth. So I think that's one of the things I'm seeing with, we've kind of got these extremes of both ends, haven't we? We've kind of got the natural birth community at the extreme, and then we've got the medical birth community at the other extreme. And actually, the truth is somewhere in the middle, and acknowledging the difference between physiology and medicine, and working with whatever the woman chooses. Some women want a medical birth. Great. Yeah. You can have a really empowering medical birth that's centered around you and what you want, and you can have choices within that. And you can also have a really empowering physiological birth. You know, it's about the woman's needs being met and how she feels during the process, not the type of birth that she's having.
Which truly goes back to having individualized care and asking that woman, what do you want? Now let's find the appropriate place to do that. Now let's find the best match, you know, person to help you do that. Okay, so in terms of induction, having a positive one, would you say that a really good strategy for induction is to try and mimic that physiological labor? So if we're working with a cervix that's really thick, not that effaced, maybe we start with something that's going to get that going, some prostaglandins. Maybe we move to a balloon, which is going to help, you know, put some pressure on that cervix before we start Pitocin. I know there's some data out there that says, if you start Pitocin and breakwaters around this or at the same time around a certain place in labor, it can yield a little bit of a shorter labor. Do you have ideas around how to have a positive induction or some tips that might make an induction better? Although induction is very much like your fingerprint, it's very individualized because it's very much based on where your cervix is, like at the beginning, you know, and the reasons that we're inducing. It's very different to choose an elective induction versus needing to have your baby out for cholestasis or, you know, anything.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to, and that's, you know, in my book on induction, I've got a whole chapter on making a birth plan for an induction, because there are decisions within that. So, and it should always be, you know, that it shouldn't be a, this is what you do, 1, 2, 3, 4. It should be an assessment. So you assess the woman's cervix, talk to her about what you're finding and the benefits and risks of ripening the cervix if it's not ripe, you know, what would happen physiologically, what we're trying to do with medicine to mimic that. And we can't really completely mimic it, because with medicine, we're just using prostaglandin, which is just one chemical that happens around the ripening of the cervix. So many other changes happen to make the structure of the cervix different when it starts to labor. So it's talking to women about the risks and benefits of that. How would she like to do that? Then the next step, you know, breaking waters. So each step of the way, it should be talking to the woman about, this is what is happening in your individual situation. This is the recommendation, and this is the reason for the recommendation, and these are the risks and benefits. What would you like to do?
Okay, so do you do the Bishop score with your clients? You do, okay. And do you talk to them about their number and what it means? And then do you have a, I guess, range of a Bishop score where you're like, this would probably lead to a successful induction versus this is induction's going to be a little bit harder because your cervix is not quite super ready?
You do. I haven't worked in hospitals for many years. So I worked in hospitals for years and years, and I went into private practice, home birth, obviously still transferred into hospital if that's what we needed to do. So I haven't been the care provider responsible for doing the medical interventions for induction. I've absolutely supported women through having inductions. And yes, so the Bishop score, you know, is just looking at different aspects of the cervix and then, you know, making, we like scores and we like flow charts in medicine because
love numbers.
We like to control bodies like they're machines when actually they're really quite messy and complicated and, you know, nothing fits numbers or yeah. And that's part of assessing how far the body has already prepared for labor and birth. But particularly with the first baby, you are working, it's not just the cervix. You know, if the woman's uterus has not matured, has not created matured oxytocin receptors, it's not going to do anything, or it's not going to do anything particularly effective once you put in Pitocin into her system, because there's no receptors on her uterus to uptake that and make a contraction happen. And you can't assess for that. You can't check their uterus to see whether their, you know, oxytocin receptors are formed. Whereas a woman who's had a baby before, she'll already have oxytocin receptors and they will be pretty responsive to Pitocin. So she has another set of risks, which is she might overstimulate in response. And this is, you know, it's so nuanced. And I think this is part of the problem with kind of general information sharing, is it's really nuanced to that individual woman, her situation, her history, her wishes, her preferences, her body. So yeah, it's and that's how it should be. And I know it's not, it's flow charts and numbers, but that's how it should be.
Which is good to have those flow charts and numbers. It does give us like a baseline. It gives us a range. It gives us a goal. It gives us a starting point, but we should be using them in an individualized way to say like, all right, here's the average. Here's what we typically see. Here's where you land. Here are the options for the people that land where you've landed comparatively to X, Y, and Z. It really is too bad that, you know, we're not seeing that. Okay, so on your Instagram, you talk a lot about the pathology of OP babies. So let's talk about OP babies, big babies, all these things that people can talk about that are kind of quote unquote scary, maybe if you don't know a lot about them, that may lead you into an unnecessary or unwanted induction or C-section.
Okay, well, it's kind of two separate things. So I look at OP. OP is just a variation. It's just physiology, very normal, not a problem. But what we have done is we've pathologized it. We've pathologized it in medicine and we've pathologized it in natural birth, which is interesting because initially medicine was arguing against, saying, no, OP is not a problem. And, you know, I kind of go into more depth in that in my blog post and the lesson that I did for the collective about the history of OP positions and where this fear has come from. But the fear has primarily come from the fact that if your baby is OP, you are more likely to have a different pattern of labor, not an abnormal one, not a problem, just a different pattern to the pattern that is expected in the flowcharts in hospital. So this idea about what a normal labor pattern is was created by, well, actually Friedman, Emmanuel Friedman cops a lot of flack for this, but it's actually, it wasn't him who made this up. He did some research into women's cervixes opening in a hospital setting in the US. A lot of them were augmented, having their labor speeded up. A lot of them were sedated, and he plotted it onto a graph. And that graph has then been grabbed and used and is still used today, even though we now have lots of really big picture research from lots of researchers internationally saying, hey, that's not how the cervix opens in labor. Okay. But that's what we're stuck with, this ridiculous partogram of a cervix opening a particular way, which it doesn't do anyway for 50% of women having their first baby. So when you add into that an OP position baby, it's even less likely to fit that, because what they tend to do is have quite stoppy starty labors, and then they're not going to turn until they get into the cavity of the pelvis. And then once they rotate and turn, often the cervix will open really quickly. So you kind of get this kind of, if you are doing vaginal examinations, which why would you, but if you're doing them, it will look like nothing's happening. When the fundus, you know, the uterus is changing shape, it's actually doing all the things. It's actually pulled the cervix up. It's just the baby's head isn't holding the cervix open, so it looks like it's not opening. And then once the baby gets into the pelvis and rotates, all of a sudden this kind of this cervix comes over its head like a jumper, and it's quite quick. But we've pathologized it. So because women's bodies aren't fitting the time frames, particularly if their baby is in an OP position, we've created this whole story pathologizing that position. in the natural birth world as well. And yes, there are some differences. Some women will have back pain, not all. But the message women are getting is if your baby's OP, you're going to have a painful, difficult, long labor, which is not necessarily true. There isn't evidence to support that. And then they end up having interventions, whether that's natural interventions like, you know, people fiddling about trying to get their baby to turn before they go into labor or using techniques or telling them they have to do certain things or not sit certain ways or have pelvic release or have this, that and the other. So we're making this woman mistrust her body, which the whole point to me of antenatal care and education is reinforcing trust in the woman's body, that she knows her body's got this. She doesn't have to think about it because it's going to happen anyway. She wants to think about it, great, go and read books, whatever. But actually, if you don't do any of that, your body's going to birth a baby. You know, that's how it works. So instead of reinforcing that message, we're reinforcing you need to do something to prepare to birth. You need to fix this fault, this problem. And here's how you do it using special external expert techniques and skills that we can teach you or we can do to you. And it's kind of the same in the natural birth movement and the medical birth movement. It's the same message that we're giving. Medicine isn't too bothered about OP babies until the woman's in labor, and then they get all uppity about it because their woman's not quick enough for their charts, or it doesn't look like she is because they can't see the future that it's going to suddenly speed up. So that's OP. I think we just need to all calm down about OP position and maybe not find it. You know, when I was practicing as a home birth midwife, I just wouldn't. In fact, not even in the hospital setting, I wouldn't document what position the baby was in other than head down, because really anything else, it doesn't matter. It's going to change, you know. Head down, you might want to know about that if a woman's in labor, but I don't want to know what position the baby's in. I have cared for women who kind of said to me, it's bloody pee, isn't it? And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't, no idea.
Not sure.
It's fine. It's like, but they've brought that with them, you know, that fear.
And if you had just reinforced it by saying like, yeah, I think your baby is OP, no telling how that would have impacted their labor.
Yeah. And I'd say, I don't know, but you're doing really well.
Yeah, it's working. That's awesome. Okay. So with OP babies, do you find kind of like funky contraction patterns, maybe something like coupling where they come 1, 2, 3, kind of right back to back. And then we've got a long pause in contractions, meaning like, you know, 8, 10, 12 minutes, and then we get a couple of them kind of right back together again, and then another long pause. Do you find that particularly with OP babies? Yeah.
Yeah, and particularly in that kind of early labor phase, until the baby gets into the pelvis, there's often that, you know, like you say, a couple close together, then a big space. And, you know, I've got a kind of hunch about that. And that's that during that space is an opportunity for the baby to descend and rotate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely.
Because it's not that pressure of the uterus on it. So, and women can rest in between their contractions. So it's, you know, not a big deal until we start overlaying the idea that birth has to be a certain way. Contractions should be, you know, every 5 minutes or less consistently, which they're often not even, not with an OP baby, but certainly with an OP baby, I wouldn't expect that. What you often get is maybe just 2 contractions every 10 minutes. Big gap in between, and the contractions might be 1 strong, 1 not so strong, a couple strong, 1 not so strong. It's just less consistent, I guess. Yeah, but it does the job.
Less rhythmic, but the body is still working. The baby is still turning. We always kind of describe coupling as like kind of what you said, the uterus is kind of like clamping down on that baby and trying to turn them in that corkscrew movement. And it's kind of like revving your engines if you're stuck in mud a little bit, like, and then you take a break and let mom rest and let that baby kind of refigure out where they are. So do you think there's anything that we need to be doing for OP babies in labor as far as like maternal positioning, any sort of, you know, jiggling? There's all sorts of techniques out there that you kind of hinted at. Should we just leave them be and they will figure it out for the most part? Is that, where do you fall in thinking?
Well, OP is just a variation of a physiological birth. So it's physiology. Yeah. So with physiology, the focus of supporting is basically minding the environment to stop anything coming in and disturbing and distracting the woman from what she's doing, and supporting her physiology and instinct, because that's safety. So if a woman is moving physiologically and instinctively, she'll know what positions to get in for that particular baby. You know, the baby's in her pelvis. Women are able to move instinctively to help their baby move through their pelvis. And anything we do might interfere with that. You know, we might be I'm guilty for that as well. You know, as a midwife, I was taught to give lots of instructions and get women actively birthing and go up and down the stairs and all of those things. And, you know, it wasn't until really I kind of did my PhD and looked at what we did and why we did it as midwives and reframed it and kind of really thought about, hang on, what messages are we giving? And are we actually interfering with what this woman needs to do to affect birth in her body? You know, I've had women do really weird positions that I would never have suggested, you know, lying flat on their back. One woman like lay flat on her back after trying to get a baby out for ages, now came the baby. That was obviously a position she needed to be in. Women who, all kinds of positions that make sense afterwards. So I think as care providers, we need to just remember that we might have this knowledge about how most pelvises are structured and, you know, the forward leaning position is really good for it, kind of mechanically, I guess, to get a baby through. But hang on, for this woman and this baby, we don't know what's happening. This baby might have a hand up here. It might need to rotate a different way in this particular pelvis. And just keeping out of it, I think, is the key for physiological birth. Now, all of these techniques, you know, the Rebozo, et cetera, I've learned them and I have used them, but they are interventions. So you use them in response to not a variation, but a complication. So there, for example, I have used the getting the baby out of the pelvis, you know, when the baby's really has wedged itself in asynclitic and the mom's aware of that, saying women know what's happened. If they're supported to birth instinctively, women will know when they need help and they'll ask for it. So, you know, when I say trust birth, it's not like trust birth and, you know, everything will go well. It's no, don't trust birth, trust yourself, trust your body, trust your instinct that you will know if you need help. So, you know, I've had women say this baby's just not going anywhere. I feel like it's wedged. And then we can help her, you know, get a bum in the air, shake the baby out of the pelvis, give it a space to lock itself back in a kind of better position. So that all these interventions have their place. I just worry about routinely using them and using them to get women's bodies to fit timeframes. Because the message you're giving the woman is, and a lot of midwives will say this to me and disagree with me, and that's fine, saying, you know, I do all these things, you know, the techniques to speed up the labor so that the woman doesn't end up being augmented, having a cesarean, having further interventions. And, you know, that protects that individual woman perhaps, but what message are you giving her? That her body's not quick enough, that her body's not functioning effectively, when really it's the system that's the problem. So we kind of reinforce that, which, you know, is why I kind of try and look at birth as a rite of passage and what messages we're giving through what we say and do, rather than just looking at the actions and the intention to save the woman. It's yes, but what are you messaging to that woman about what it is, you know, what her body is capable of and her future mothering capacity?
Yeah, you can say so much and not even utter a single word. I agree with, like, what messages are we sending underneath it all? So the idea of, like, these things are interventions rather than, like, supportive, almost proactive things to do is kind of new to our team. And we started to adopt it a couple months ago and actually think about the things that we're doing instead of routinely recommending them to people to try out during late pregnancy. We started to say, you know, like, if you feel like you need this, here is something. And people now use what feels good to them rather than giving something that was told to them to do because they're doing it just because it was told to them to do. It's really cool to hear you talk about, like, it is, these things are interventions, because it's something that we had noticed too. And we just kind of made a shift as a team to say, like, all right, let's teach them to people and then leave it to them in their hands to kind of, like, energetically, what do you need today? Take what serves you today. And then tomorrow do whatever feels good to you. Then it could be the same thing. It could be nothing. It could be something different.
And I think the important thing to consider with intervention, because I get a lot of kickback on this is one of my topics when I upset people, is that everything that we do and say is an intervention. So my presence in a birth will alter the experience and the physiology of that birth. And we really need to start seeing that and acknowledging it, and then really thinking about, what is it that I'm doing? Am I influencing this in a good way or a bad way, a helpful way or not a helpful way? You know, for example, massaging a woman's back is an intervention, but actually a lot of women really like that intervention and it helps them to relax and feel comfort. So it's actually an intervention that promotes physiology. For some women, it doesn't. Some women absolutely hate being touched, and that's going to alter their physiology in a way that doesn't, you know, improve oxytocin release, etc. So it's about understanding that everything we say and do is an intervention, and that intervention isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know, but it's not just a medical thing either. Everything is an intervention. And, you know, you might really want a medical intervention in some scenarios and you might not in others. So, yeah, the word intervention is a bit of a trigger.
Bit of a buzzword. So do you think that the rise in induction that we've seen in the last couple of years is in any way connected to the rise in cesareans that we've seen as well? Do you think those are connected in any way?
Well, it's just medicalized birth in general, isn't it? It's kind of, it's the loss of physiological birth. I think if we kind of flip it and see it in that way, it's kind of more helpful to look at what's happening to physiological birth, you know, which is why when I say, if you're going into a setting to give birth, or if you're assessing a particular setting, like, you know, hospital, birth center, midwife, private practice midwife, whatever it is, if you want to get a kind of idea about how good they are at supporting physiology, the statistic that you want is what proportion of first-time mothers who are low risk in your care go into spontaneous labor, labor without any augmentation, and give birth vaginally without any instruments and without an episiotomy. That number tells you everything. Mm. And I can tell you it's usually around about, for first-time mothers, 15%. In Australia. Varies, of course, for home birth midwives, it'll be much higher because their entire expertise is around supporting physiology and et cetera. So the rise in medicalization, we're going to see a rise in induction alongside a rise in cesarean because it increases cesarean for women having their first babies. We're going to see that, but it's just a general shift towards medicalization. Which is so interesting to me because the last decade of research, so we've only had research really since the 1990s, and the last decade in particular, we've had all these really good studies demonstrating the importance of physiological birth for women and babies, short-term, long-term, and the risks and dangers of routine medicalization of birth. It's all there, and yet practice continues to hurtle towards increased medicalization all the way along. And then when you ask why that's happening, it's women are blamed, aren't they? You know, that we do victim blaming. Oh, well, women are either too fat, too old, they're old and healthy. And it's the same with the OP babies, isn't it? You know, it's like they're all just sitting on their ass too long and, you know, baby gets into a bad position and they're all traumatized and holding tension in their pelvis, so they're getting their babies in the wrong position. It's like, hang on. This is not really about women. There has always been women who have had complications and need, you know, medical support. But you can't tell me that within a generation, we are now most women, the vast majority of women need to have medical births to have a good outcome. That's not what's happening here. And then they say, well, women want it. Women want epidurals. They want inductions. That's not what the research tells us. Quite the opposite. The vast majority of women actually want to give birth, I'm using quotes here, natural birth, because that's how it's framed from the kind of consumer perspective, I guess, is that most women want to give birth with as little interventions as possible. So it's not women who are the problem here. It's continuing. And a lot of it is, you know, fun in the US in particular, it's funding, it's money. There's more money in increasing medicalization. And interestingly here, I couldn't understand when I moved from the UK to Australia why it was still happening in public hospitals in Australia. And what I found out was that for the public hospital, their funding is based on what they spend the previous year. So for them, you know, physiological natural birth would reduce their costs, so then they get less funding the following year. So there's no incentive. There's no incentive to have a physiological birth or to lower the intervention rates. There is absolutely no incentive.
I hope everyone at home is listening and just realizing this is at your expense. Like, it's not that there's no, like, bad that can happen to this. The bad happens to you. It's birth trauma. It's unwanted interventions. It's unwanted C-sections. It's not having any more children because your first time was so horrendous you couldn't possibly think about doing it again. Like, these decisions are being made at your expense. So when you're being offered an induction, make sure that you're truly informed. So Dr. Reed, what would you say? How would you counteract? So let's say someone has just come from the hospital and you can assume they got the same rundown that everyone kind of gets at the hospital, that induction is safe and it reduces your C-section risk and 39 weeks is when we should do it and may even lead to a shorter labor. And aren't you done being pregnant? Don't you want to meet your baby? We're going to use Pitocin. It's just like oxytocin. And you come in one day and we have your baby the next. And that's the rundown they got at the hospital. How do you counteract that? What are the things that their hospital left out in this conversation?
Well, they left out the benefits of physiological birth, because that should be the starter. And, you know, in my book about induction, I've actually got a whole thing about decision making that kind of takes women through what each step and what to ask. What's the rationale for inducing you? Because you can't rely actually on care providers to do that. So that's kind of the framework, is to work through the what's the rationale for it? What's the risks, benefits, all of that stuff? How will this alter what I was hoping for my birth? Because, you know, for a woman who wanted to have an epidural in labor and wants to have a medical birth, induction is not going to change her experience that much. A woman who wanted to have a water birth in a birth center, that's going to be a significant shift from what it was that she was wanting to have. So that needs to come into it. How is it going to alter what you were planning? What are the risks for the baby longer term? Were you wanting to breastfeed? How are you going to support a baby who is not ready yet to initiate breastfeeding and work with that baby? Have you got support for that if you choose to have an induction? It's so complex. It should be a long conversation, and it should be centered around, you know, yes, structure. And I've got a little structure for it, but you don't need to have it structured necessarily. But it's about looking at how the process alters physiology, what it is that the woman wanted, what are the risks and benefits, what's the rationale, is it supported in evidence? And then, you know, really, it should be, the conversation should be finished with what would you like to do? I'll support you either way. And I know that doesn't happen. So what we have is women, I mean, luckily, you know, we now do have a massive increase in doulas and support that women are actually bringing into their birth journeys to support them and advocate for them. Because, you know, and that's the other thing about the whole victim blaming is, I often get women going, oh, I wish I'd known that. And I said yes to having an induction because I believed them. And then they're beating themselves up about that. It's like, you are not to blame for believing what a care provider tells you. You shouldn't have to go in with all of the research and evidence. And when somebody suggests something to you, this is another bugbear, is I often get messages from people, and in my collective, a lot of the Q&As are doulas and midwives saying, hey, the obstetrician's recommending this. What's the evidence that that isn't the case? That shouldn't be done. And I'm always like, hang on, whoa, whoa, whoa. If the obstetrician is recommending a thing, the onus is on him or her to give you the evidence to support what they're recommending. It's not on you and us to scrabble about trying to prove that it's all right to not follow the recommendation. Like, we need to really kind of reframe that and support women to understand that the system's not out to get them, in that that individual obstetrician is not going, I'm going to ruin this woman's birth.
Like, yeah.
They're coming from a perspective where they genuinely feel that this is the safest thing for the woman and baby, that this is how it should be, and that's in her best interest. And that's a whole paternalistic thing, right? So the intention is good, but they also need to understand that they only have one part of the argument. They are coming from their perspective. And if your perspective doesn't align, that's okay. You know, ultimately, the outcome is yours, you know, as a woman who's having the baby, not theirs. So it's about talking to women about how the hospital systems work without fear-mongering, because it doesn't need to be fear-mongering. You know, I write in my book about reclaiming childbirth about sharing the map. And that's about, you know, for doulas, educators, midwives, to share the map of whichever system the woman's birthing in. So, you know, in this hospital, this is the usual practice. This is the culture. You know, VBAC's not well supported, or it is. You know, so that the woman can kind of look at that and go, okay, what do I need to do to navigate this particular system I've chosen to birth in, or sometimes not, because they have no other choice. And to know their rights in that as well, because sharing the map is also sharing their legal rights, and they can say no to anything, even if it means they'll die, they can say no to it. So I think it's like a much bigger than just induction thing. We need to kind of support women to step into their power and advocate alongside them to do that.
Which just goes back to that conversation of individualized care and having that conversation of consent and, you know, putting the control back into their hands. No, yeah, I agree 100% with what you're saying about the onus should not fall on the patient, on the client, on that mom. The onus should fall on the provider to prove that what they're saying is evidence-based, and that's why they're recommending it. But unfortunately, I know there's so many people out there who are like, that's just not the case. I get it, you guys. I'm sorry. It's just not what we have right now. Okay. I think we've done a really great job of kind of peeling back the layers of induction and what people maybe aren't told in the hospital system. There are certainly risks to the medications. You had hinted at certain things. You know, Pitocin comes with its own risk of uterine rupture and having too many contractions too fast and funky fetal heart tones. And these are conversations that you should be having with your provider. These are the things that your provider should be talking to you about when you have an induction. What are the risk of the cervical ripeners? What are the risk of the balloon? What are the risk of Pitocin? And you can ask too. So if you are having this one-sided conversation and you recognize it as like, wait, they've only told me about the benefits, or wait, they've only told me the good things about these things, you should ask, and what risk should I be aware of? What are the risks associated with these things? What kind of risks come with these different methods for induction, or, you know, with the medication that you're recommending, whatever it may be? But don't ever feel like you can't ask about the risk. You can't have a conversation, because you absolutely can. If you're having a conversation about the good, the pros, you should also talk about the cons too, because you need that in order to make a decision. You need to know the risk and if it's worth it to you to take that risk for the hoped outcome, because that at the end of the day is what an induction is. We're hoping we can get your body to have a vaginal delivery with as little intervention as possible. And sometimes it doesn't work. That is, at the end of the day, what an induction is.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, Dr. Reed, where can people find your books that you've mentioned? You have a couple courses. You also have a blog. I follow along with your newsletter. Where can people connect with you if what you said today kind of resonated with them, or they wanted to learn more about induction?
I guess the hub is my website. So that would be www.rachelreed.website. But I'm also on social media as Dr. Rachel Reed on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. So you can kind of find me if you search for me. And then on the website, you'll be able to find my books and courses. Yeah, that's where I am.
I love it. All right. Is there anything else that you want to leave our listeners with in terms of induction, or maybe not induction, maybe just taking control of your birth, whatever feels good to you?
No, just that you actually can say no, that is an option. Even if you've been presented with overwhelming evidence, and even if it's true, you can still say no. You know, at the end of the day, the baby's going to come out of your body. You will give birth. No woman that I know of yet has been pregnant for, you know, years and years. It's going to happen. And you can say no to any intervention to that.
I love it. All right, you guys, thanks for joining us today. I hope you're leaving up as jazzed as I feel right now. You should know your rights going into the hospital. You should feel confident in your decisions, hold those boundaries, be flexible in your birth plan because birth is ever changing. But it does reinforce the idea that if you don't know your options, then you don't have any, and you no longer have the control of that room. So the way that you can stay in control of the decisions made in your labor is understanding your options and knowing your rights. And I'm being confident in the choices that you make. All right, you guys, it was fun hanging out with you. I will see you again next week on another episode of the Birth Launch Podcast. Bye, y'all. Have you been looking for a way to prepare your partner for birth? I know you know how important it is that they're educated on not only like what's normal in birth, but also what are your options? How can they help relieve some of the sensations and pains of labor? What positions can they get you in? How can they support you in pushing? How can they advocate for you? But I also know that it's pretty hard to find information, resources, classes, courses that are, you know, kind of specifically for a dad supporting you in labor. And so I wanted to introduce to you Dad Days. This is a course obviously meant for husbands so that they can understand everything I just said. I'm going to talk them through what normal birth looks like so that they can understand what is normal and safe and expected and what's not. I'm going to talk to them about variations in labor and what they should do, what they mean, and if they need to call the doctor, if they can reassure you that things are safe, if they can say, oh yeah, remember he taught me this in Dad Days. I'm also going to teach them about the psychology of things. I want them to understand what these changes feel like for you mentally, emotionally, physically, so that they can be the best support. We're also going to talk about each stage of labor and how they can help you with pain relief and comfort measures. Then, of course, I'm going to prepare them for afterbirth. We're going to talk about how they can support you in maintaining a positive and calm environment, how to be an active listener. We're going to talk about what they need to know about postpartum emotions and hormones and how that may impact your relationship and what role they can be to be the best support for you. And then finally, because we know the science so strongly suggests that having an educated and supportive partner of breastfeeding can be such an influential factor in your breastfeeding relationship, I'm also going to prepare them for breastfeeding. What they can do to bond with your baby, what they can do to encourage you to bond with your baby, and how do you re-split up the household tasks because you're going to be taking on all of baby duties or the majority of it. And so they are going to have to pick up some other slack in other ways. What will that look like? Dad Days is designed to change your partner's life. This is not only going to prepare them to speak up and advocate and support you and understand what you're going through in pregnancy and postpartum, but it's really going to empower them to have the confidence to be that active participant in parenthood where they are not just showing up to do the task, but they're actually active. They're engaged. They enjoy it. They bring ideas to the table. They have the confidence to take the initiative to make your workload and your life balance easier. I want this for you. I created this course to help you educate your partner alongside the information that I give you in the Birth Lounge. And so you can think about the Birth Lounge and the Dad Days course as kind of a husband and wife. The Dad Days course is specifically for dads. The Birth Lounge is made for moms, but also your partners can go through it too to learn so much. So they go together. They're like peanut butter and jelly, but do know that they can stand alone as well. If you want to learn more about that, you can visit thebirthlounge.com/daddays. That's D-A-D-D-A-Z as in zebra, E, Dad Days, because postpartum can feel a little foggy, but our Dad Days course is going to bring clarity to dads around birth. See you there. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I truly do value this community and I love hanging out with you. If you found today's episode helpful, share it with a friend. Share it with someone who might also find this information helpful. I'd love to hear what you have to say and read your sweet words on iTunes. You can leave us a review and this helps get this information into the hands of parents who might also benefit from hearing it. If you're interested in joining the Birth Lounge, You can go to thebirthlounge.com. Our blog is linked there. You can find all sorts of free information as well as how to get your access to the Birth Lounge. You can always hang out with me on Instagram as well, at Tranquility by Hehe. Until then, stay educated, stay supported, stay confident.